Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, this is Craig. If you like this show and you want to support it and you want to keep it free, head on over to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/support. If you're a business owner and you want to increase your cash flow, or if you're a label or artist and you want to promote new music, then listen up. For information about advertising on Everyone Loves Guitar, including information on geographically targeted ads, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. If you want to buy or sell a home or investment property and you're here in the Tampa Bay area, in Hillsborough, Pinellas, or Pasco counties, then listen up. West Florida Real Estate is a local residential real estate broker that's helped over 250 Bay Area homeowners buy and sell their properties in the last 4 years alone. If you're looking to sell, you'll want to get their free report, The 7 Biggest Mistakes Homeowners Make When Hiring a Realtor. And if you're looking to buy a property, you definitely want to get your hands on The 21 Most Expensive Mistakes Tampa Home Buyers Make When Buying a Home. Each one of these reports is going to save you time and money. Inside, you'll discover the 7 most important things to consider when hiring a realtor, what to do if you're buying and selling a home at the same time, and the danger of choosing a realtor who agrees with everything you say. To get your hands on these free reports, head on over to westfloridarealestate.com. That's westfloridarealestate.com. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. And we are with a quintessential lifetime sideman today with Grant Tai. Just a quick reminder before we move forward, remember that you can now, if you're listening to the podcast on in your car or whatever, you could also now watch it live on YouTube at look up Everyone Loves Guitar on the YouTube channel. All righty, with Grant Tai. He grew up all over the place. He was a military brat, I think, right?
Well, my father worked for the Corps of Engineers. He was in the military, but he was an engineer. So when I was born in Dallas, Texas, and he was building the Canyon Dam, which was outside of Boston. And then that project was done, and we moved up to Buena Vista, Colorado briefly. I don't really know what he was working on up there. And then we moved to Mississippi, Clinton, Mississippi, and we stayed there for quite a while. So he was working around that area.
Very cool. I'll ask you some questions about that. In Mississippi, he started fooling around with a guitar that was his brother's, soaked up the sounds around that area from juke joints, honky tonks, and churches. Man, I always read about juke joints, and they sound so cool.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, you've seen pictures of what one is. It's really a shack on some cinder blocks, but it's like, you know, where the shit was going down.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Where are we going to go play? Where are we going to go listen to music and drink some whiskey or something? And that was it.
I'm from the Bronx. We didn't have any juke joints there.
Yeah. Juke joints on the corner. It's a bar. That's all it is.
Of sorts.
Yeah, it's a bar where people are playing music. But obviously I was young then, but that was such a small town. It was hard to not be exposed to what was going on around there. You know, there was gospel music coming out the door of the churches. And, country radio all through around there. Clinton, Mississippi is outside of Jackson. And at that time, it was a really pretty rural, fairly rural area.
Yeah. That's cool, man. He then started playing blues and rock shows throughout the Southeast, Florida, Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, and Texas. Moved to LA in 81 to attend Guitar Musician Institute, honing his chops in original bands, playing loads of clubs in the LA and Hollywood area, and also backing up Elvis impersonators throughout the Southwest. That had to be cool, no?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, I went to GIT, and that was a really cool experience for me. You know, a lot of really great players were in that class, and they're like Frank Gambale, who is a monster player, was in from Australia, and he was you know, in a lot of ways on the same level as the teachers there already. But I think he came to meet musicians and get out of Australia and come to LA.
Yeah.
But we were all going to class together. We became friends and played in performances together. And Scott Henderson was there.
Sure.
And I was there. And there's more that, you know, that I probably am not aware of that other people would be aware of too. It was a hot time. There were a lot of, it was kind of somewhat at the beginning of that school.
Was Pete Anderson there?
Pete Anderson was coming through.
Tim Godwin was there then?
Yeah. Yeah. And that was interesting because obviously it's the early 80s. So it was a weird mix. There would be guys like Frank Ambali who he showed up just like playing every Steely Dan thing that you could think of. And he had incredible chops. But he was also into learning things that were more rootsy that I was into at the time, you know, like Lowell George, like Little Feet and stuff sure. like that. So we ended up playing that stuff together. And he was much more advanced than I was, but he was into kind of learning that kind of stuff from the American guys. And but then there was all these shredders, you know, tons of these guys that were into Van Halen and Alan Holdsworth and stuff like that, that were, so it was really cool just to be crammed together and exposed to all these incredibly talented people. You know, that was it really set everyone off on a trajectory. You know, it's like you're getting gigs from being at that school, whatever it was. That's how I ended up being in a band beyond that, because these two guys I met that were playing bass and drums were living in the apartment building with me.
So that was when Howard Roberts was like his method, right?
Yeah.
Of teaching.
Yeah.
Because I had Pete on the show, and Pete was telling me he really loved that, and he didn't understand why they ever changed the curriculum. He said he got so much out of that. He didn't it really helped, you know, shape him musically, you know, that curriculum there.
Right, right. It was just sort of a way of looking at things and playing, you know. So, yeah, I never really thought about that.
But yeah.
Yeah, it's true.
And
cool people would come through, you know, like Pete, Tommy Tedesco.
Oh, wow.
Like this veteran session guy.
The Wrecking Crew, he was the guy, wasn't
right.
he? Yeah.
Right. So people like that would come through. And in a lot of ways, you would learn things from them that applied to being a musician and were about music, but it was different than like what you're, you know, in the curriculum. It was like, oh, this is how you deal with being a sideman. This is how you deal with being a session guy and get around maybe your weaknesses and deal with the situation that you're in. You know, he had a lot of, and he was hilarious. The guy was
Tommy. Now he wrote I have not read his book. Have you seen or read his book? He's got a book.
I have not read his book. And then I think there's a documentary that his son put out.
I haven't seen that one. It was on the whole Wrecking Crew. It was like,
I can't remember if that's the one that his son was involved in or not.
Make a note here and check that out, because there was one on the whole Wrecking Crew. You know, it was him, Carol Kay. It was a great, very good documentary, but I know he wrote a book, and I've heard it mentioned a few times by a couple of guys I interviewed here, and I was just curious. More on Grant, 1985. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
In 85, he formed a band called Dick Holliday and the Bamboo Gang with Brad Nye. When I was reading this the other night, I'm like, Ty and Nye, what are the...
That is odd, yeah.
The chances.
That's the guys I was telling you about that...
The drummer and the bass player that lived in...
Right, so I moved out there. Before that, I was living in San Antonio briefly, and this guy I was living with he was from Houston. He's like, yeah, I'll go to guitar school with you. You know, he was into guitar. So we went out there, and we were in this apartment right off of Hollywood Boulevard. It was pretty sleazy.
That's what everybody says.
There was just like, transsexual hookers walking right out the front, you know, right as you walk out. They're like, hey, honey, you know. But
welcome,
these two young guys were in an apartment. They were from Illinois. They were from Moline, Illinois. Really talented drummer and singer, which was Brad Nye, and Clem, who his real name is Greg Hayes, but his nickname is Clem, was a great bass player. And we immediately became friends. And Brad had Brad is in school, and he meets this drummer there at school who worked for Van Halen. as a security guy. He's like this big, burly, no neck guy. And my friend Brad, who's this really charismatic guy, he goes, think I could get a job doing that? He's like, oh, sure, I'll introduce you to him. I don't know. And Brad, of course, goes and meets the management, and he doesn't get, because this guy was like a security guy that's down in the crowd,
right,
dealing with the drunks. Brad gets the job hanging out backstage.
Holy, you know, smoke.
Making sure there's no brown M&Ms and chasing young girls out of David Lee Roth's hotel room because their daddy's in the lobby of the hotel.
Wow. That's not a bad gig.
Yeah. He took Eddie Van Halen and Valerie Bertinelli to see Spinal Tap.
Wow. That's interesting.
And Eddie,
holy smokes.
Eddie goes, that's just too real, man. Brad, that's freaking me out.
That's really funny. It's like Eddie and his ex-wife. That is wild.
So he banked a bunch of dough working for Van Halen, and then subsequently after that he worked for Hall & Oates. And when he got back to Chicago, he contacted me and said, hey, I've been writing songs. We had every now and then when we could get together, we would write tunes together. And he goes, look, we got some tunes. I want to put a band together. So I flew out to Chicago. We recorded a few tunes and we played a gig. And at that point, I was sick of playing with Elvis impersonators around LA. And I said, I put all my stuff in my car and drove to Chicago.
And that was it. That was Dick Holliday.
That was the beginning. And we had a pretty fast trajectory. It was weird. We had been writing a bunch of originals, and then we filled out the set with some sort of obscure covers.
Like what?
Like we would do like Little Feat tunes or Fabulous Thunderbirds or The Spinners or Marvin Gaye, or just not current stuff, like old
deep
stuff.
Deep cuts, kind of?
Yeah, kind of. And up to the point where sometimes after a while, they were obscure enough to where people thought they were our tunes.
Oh, wow.
Because we had changed the arrangements or whatever. But we started playing shows, and within 1 year, we opened for a popular band in Chicago at this club, or it's a theater called Park West, which is a 2,000-seater.
Oh, that's great.
And it was New Year's Eve, and we opened for this band, and we were very good at stealing other bands' crowds. And so within a year, we were headlining clubs in the Chicago area, and then started playing the Midwest, and then kind of all over the country.
Now, then it says you toured throughout the country, as you said, Mexico, Caribbean, and you wound up recording 4 CDs. One of them was financed by A&M. What happened? I mean, it's the quintessential.
It's the typical, thing, especially back then. Everybody's scrambling trying to get a major label deal. And we got a guy, his name was Craig Lambert, who was an A&R guy for A&M, and he was interested in us, and he got money as a development deal for us to make a record. And then it's just the thing that happened to most of the bands that I knew. It's like you find your champion at the record company, and then they either quit or get fired. And then the people don't want to have anything to do with you. So then, okay, start over again. And you find another. So, it was all about.
Wow. So that's literally how it works. Like when your contact leaves, your relationship to that company is predicated 100% on like the person that found you.
It really it was like that. It was like if somebody felt good about you, they're lobbying as they went along. And if they didn't have enough time at the company to build a coalition of people that would get behind you, if they were gone, that would just dry up. And the whole rug would get yanked out from under you. So we had that happen quite a bit. And another thing was with that band, I think they couldn't quite figure out how to market it. We were a little
common problem. Yeah.
We were great live and very entertaining. And that's why they're like, how do we do this? We got to somehow figure out how to market this band. And I don't think they could ever sink their teeth into how to do it.
Yeah. A lot of times it comes down to, they didn't know, I've talked to loads of people where they didn't know what bin to put you in.
That's it.
You know, record stores. Yeah.
Yeah, that was really it. And back then too, especially, labels were all about that, the bin. Like they wanted you to, so they would look at your material and try to narrate, write more songs like this,
Right.
Where live people like that there was more variety. Mm. happening. But for radio and the way they thought about it, it's like find the hit and write the same hit over and over.
it was really like that. This was like Chicago based, the band?
We were based in Chicago, but we had pockets around the country that we would go to quite often, like the Southeast in the Carolinas around Charleston and that area, and Georgia. We had a pretty big following, so we would go there every 2-3 months, play a few shows there. And then we were going to New York and L.A., and we played China Club out in Aspen quite a bit.
So you had to get some big clubs.
Oh, yeah, definitely. We had stuff going on.
It's interesting. I've interviewed guys specifically to book gigs, and they're always talking about, you know, the first thing to do is you farm your radius of, you know, 50 miles around. You know, you beat that to death. But you guys really wound up having, you know, multiple pockets around the country, which is awesome.
Yeah, well, you know, we were beating the Midwest to death, so we thought, well, if we can get out, you know, we can give it a rest around Chicago, because for a while there, we were playing every week in Chicago. Luckily, people would come out and see us, but sure, we were making a living, a pretty good living, put ourselves on salary just on the Midwest, and they're like, well, we got to get out. We got to spread out so we can give this area a break.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah.
So after that, early 90s, you toured. So what did you guys like collectively say, hey, listen, man, this is going nowhere. Our guy is gone. We can't keep starting over.
I think we burnt out. We were just going at it so hard. And it was the only thing that all of us were doing. So we were making a living doing that. We didn't have other projects or anything. So we had to work a lot. And mainly Brad just kind of was like, I'm tired of being a cheerleader on this. I want to just like go do something else, you know. I'm going to take a break. And this was sort of after we had something going with Chuck Lavelle, who was the keyboard player, Stones and Weather Report. He lived out in Charleston, South Carolina, and he would come sit in with us, which was a great experience. And he was like, I want to see if I can do something with you guys. And then he got distracted off. It may have been some Stones tour came up or something. He's like, he just disappeared.
Right.
So that was, we were kind of like, okay, let's take a break from this. And that was when most of the rhythm section ended up with this girl singer who had opened up for us named Kathy Richardson, who is now the lead singer of Jefferson Starship.
Oh, okay.
Next place. Yeah. So we had a little run with her after that. Yeah.
Man, this is really weird. So this whole show is really, it's a very small world, but weird shit always happens. So 3 days ago, I was just talking to a guitar player in New York, John McCurry. Do you know him by any chance?
Sounds familiar. Yeah.
He's like our age group, you know? So, I mean, he's been around a while, super nice guy, Sideman, you know, and he just told, I mean, this is literally, it was Sunday I talked to him. Today's two days ago. He's doing a gig with Chuck Lavelle. He goes, I'm doing a gig with Chuck Lavelle. He goes, you know who that is? I'm like, yeah, he's a keyboard player for the Allman Brothers. He played with the Stones. And he goes, yeah. He goes, I think he'd want to come on your show. I'm like, great. And now, like, no one's mentioned Chuck Lavelle in 550 episodes. And now, like, so this is so weird, man. This is always happens. And so now, obviously, Chuck, this is like the universe saying, hey, man, Chuck Lavelle's coming on your show. This is so, I mean, yeah. I'm like, got goosebumps. It's just so, it's like weird in a good way. I don't, you know, it's like, like electricity, man.
Yeah. We would play with him in Charleston. We'd play a club in the old historic part of town. When we'd come, we'd do 3 nights there. Then we'd do 3 nights out on the Isle of Palms on the beach. And Chuck would come out and sit in with us, our keyboard player. You know, he'd be like, well, you play piano and I'll play B3, you know. And
oh, he's such a great B3 player, man.
So, yeah, they'd be switching off and it was, and the place was just packed, and you know, you can imagine.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Very cool. I've seen him also with the with Government Mule a couple of times. He's, you know, just shared the stage with them a couple of times.
Great guy and a super talented.
That's cool, man. mid-90s. Okay, so you, then you worked, you did three CDs with Kathy Richardson. After, did she get the Jefferson Starship gig after that? Is that why that thing ended, or?
Well, I actually left her band actually a couple of times to join some other things. And I guess a couple of years after I left, she ended up in this show called Love Janis, which was about Janis Joplin.
Sure.
It was a musical that went to New York, and it was very popular. And then it ended up going out to San Francisco.
Oh, wow.
And it became, obviously, became sort of an installation there. Yeah. That's how she met the Holding Company, Janis's old band, and all, you know, Paul Kantner and all these guys from that era.
Out in San Fran.
And they're like, holy crap, you are an incredible woman. You know, we want you. So she started playing with, she did a little bit with the Holding Company. And then there, the Paul Kantner and those guys are like, you know, we can't get Grace to tour with us, but would you come out with us? And that just was like perfect.
You know? Wow.
So it became, you know, this younger version of a great singer that these guys from the 60s could latch onto and resurrect.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
It's funny. You mentioned the Holding Company. There were some great, that, I don't know the guy's name, but, you know, the famous intro to Summertime, the Janis.
Right.
He's passed, because I would have loved to have him on the show. Man, that is something else, man. You don't hear intro is like 5 minutes long, man. You don't hear stuff like that anymore, you know?
That's true. Yeah.
I love
that. That's really great. So okay. I played with her for a while, and we were kind of just playing clubs around Chicago mainly. And that was when I ended up playing with this band Sonia Dada, which is from Chicago, but they were on Capricorn. So they were a big band. They, you know, we toured, we did Conan O'Brien. We were playing big theaters, selling out big theaters.
How did you find your experience with Capricorn? Because I've had several guys on here that, in a nutshell, Capricorn kind of ruined their career because of exactly what you said about A&M. They did not know how to market. Like, they were like Southern Rock. And if you weren't Southern Rock, it was like, you know, sorry, we signed you, but we don't know what to do with you.
Yeah. Well, one thing that was happening with that band was, so they're on Capricorn, but the leader of the band, Dan Pritzker, is from this Pritzker family.
Oh, the real estate billionaire. Yeah. Banking.
Yeah. They own hotels and all kinds of stuff. So in a sense, it was sort of like, oh, okay, you can't do anything, Capricorn. I'll just bank this.
Holy smokes.
After a while, it was really, he didn't need a record company. He actually had more resources than a record company. You know, although that there's still problem, there's connections and problems with, but at that time, you know, they had, and he just put out this movie called Bolden with Wynton Marcellus, the same guy, Dan Pritzker.
What's that about?
It's about the sort of the origins of jazz in New Orleans. And it was this trumpet player that sort of broke out and was, it just was released like a month or so ago.
I have to check that out.
Collaboration with Wynton Marcellus. But
that's funny.
That band, at the time, super talented group of people, and they had a lot going for them. And we were touring around in a bus and selling out theaters. And I got the job because there was this little bit of a falling out with their original guitar player. So I went through this sort of lengthy auditioning process between me and some other people. And I think I lost out, and then the guy didn't work out. So then they called me from the road, and I went out there, and I was touring with them for a while. And then they made up with their original guitar player, and I got canned after a while.
I was going to ask you, that's got to be a little weird when, like, you lost out, but then you're going out. That's kind of, I would imagine that, like, I'd feel a little weird about that, right?
It was weird. I mean, it's one of those things where, like, well, this is weird, but this is a really cool gig, and it's an opportunity, so I'm just going to swallow up any kind of anxiety I have about it and just jump on the train.
Yeah. It's like being someone's ex-girlfriend and coming back. I don't know. Right. I could just imagine that would be a, you know, you just got to feel like you're on eggshells a little bit.
Definitely. Yeah. There is weird. There was, not only was there that, but then there's like, okay, when is the original guy that we were replacing going to make amends and want his job back?
So you knew, you had it in the back of your head that this is only a matter of time.
I'm like, okay, this is going to go however long it might, but I should always be prepared to be sent, you know, with an apple and a bus ticket. An apple. We're great having you, but see you.
Yeah. An apple and a bus ticket. I like that. So you were with them and you did well. Then you, the Juleps were formed, combining Epic recording artists, the Insiders, and then Kathy Richardson again. And there was two tours and a couple of CDs out of that. How did that go?
That was really fun. That was, those are old friends of mine, the Insiders. And I currently am actually doing records and playing with Jay O'Rourke, who was the guitar player. Who is actually a guy you probably, I can see if he'd be willing to talk to you, but he has great stories. He's a guitarist and he's a producer. He has his own studio and he, unique situation in the '80s, you know, I never really heard of this happening, but you know, a band gets signed by Epic and the guitar player is allowed to produce the record, which
That's interesting. Yeah, because usually they're you know, the record companies want to control everything.
Yeah, I mean, they let Tom Scholz do that with Boston, but he had to actually sneak around and redo the tracks back at his studio because they didn't like what you know, the record company was doing. But anyway, we got together with the guys from the Insiders, great songwriters. Gary Yerkins is a great songwriter, and we're working with Kathy, and it was sort of this sort of country rock kind of a thing, real raucous country rock stuff.
So you've had a really good, a long-term rapport with Kathy.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. For a pretty long run there, we were working together all the time.
That's really cool.
And every now and then I still do. She comes back to Chicago and we'll do, lately the times that I've played with her were, there's a band in Chicago called the Zimmerman that do Dylan stuff. And the band.
It's funny, the Zimmerman that does Dylan stuff. Yeah, yeah, that's funny.
So it's Zimmerman and then there's the Zim Women. So it's a big band and like we'll do the Last Waltz or something.
Okay.
Lots of Dylan and Kathy, if she's in town, will come out and do some stuff.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's definitely cool.
And then, okay. Then you started in late 90s, and I don't know what this is, so I'm going to ask you, in alt country with Robbie Fulks. What is alt country? Sorry, man.
That's another one of those Ben things, you know, the record company. You know, it's like, what do we call this or whatever? But, you know, the odd thing about alt country or indie country or whatever is it kind of like you're trying to squeeze something down, but really what it is in a lot of cases is, you know, that covers bands like Uncle Tupelo and Wilco.
Okay.
They were, you know, at least early on called alt country. They kind of moved
Wilco
alt because Jeff Tweedy was, you know, in Uncle Tupelo, which was much more sort of rootsy. And then they kind of went and morphed into different things. But so alt country could sort of go from Wilco to like Robbie Fulks, who, especially at the time when I first started playing with him, it's more like, it's not mainstream country. So it's like, it's not Nashville country. It's not pop country. It actually sounds like old country.
Because I was going to say Nashville country is not Nashville. Not old country anymore. That's far from it.
So that's what's odd is alt country, the way I see it.
It's like Western swing.
It's like real country.
That's
like
funny,
Western swing, like Dale Watson or, you know, so it would encompass Western swing and it almost encompasses people that were legends, you know, Merle Haggard, Willie Nelson, Emmylou Harris, Buddy Miller and his wife. It sort of becomes this, it's the alternative to bro country or pop country. It's real country. It's rockabilly. It's American music. You know, And this like label called Bloodshot, you know, was alt country. And, you know, a lot of people came through that. Funny. Brian Adams, you know, so it's a huge umbrella, really.
So like Steve Earle would be alt country.
Exactly. Exactly. It's country rock. It's rockabilly. It's Americana. It's homage to older styles of country. And Robbie was really into that hillbilly country and almost a musicologist in that sense. But he had such an adventurous, experimental spirit that we even did a record called Couples in Trouble that was really not country at all. It was very experimental. So he could go from straight hillbilly, bluegrass even, to avant-garde.
So it's like Nels Klein, Wilco. Exactly. Yeah, I had Nels over here, man. He's a great guy, actually.
And Robbie is a monstrous, you know, guitar player, flat picker, and songwriter, you know. And really the word genius gets thrown around a lot. But in his case, he does have that type of brain. He's like one of those guys that knows thousands of songs off the top of his head and is a brilliant lyricist and a brilliant musician. And he sort of operates always at a kind of a higher level. I remember when I'd be off the road with him for a while and then we would hop in the van to go on the road. I'd be like, all right, I better tune up my brain to just hang out with Robbie, even on a humor level.
Sure. I've met a few guys like that. It's pretty,
very smart. It's like, okay, you got to step up. Not only musically on stage,
right?
In general, or you'll get called out, you know.
You know, one thing about your career, it's very different than a lot of sidemen. Most sidemen do not go in the studio as often as you have, by a long shot.
Yeah, a lot of times I'm in this position too, where you're like, okay, we're going on the road or we're going on stage and you just need to cop what the other guy did on the record.
Right.
Which I've done plenty of that.
Yeah, and that's the more common trajectory. But you've recorded, like, we just talked now probably about 7 or 8 or 9, 10 CDs that you've been involved with.
Oh, yeah.
That's a lot of, as a sideman in the band, that's a lot.
Yeah. So it's sort of like hopping from, you know, I always say I'm a good coattail rider. So my whole career has been sniffing out a quality coattail to hop onto. Sort of like, ooh, this guy, these people are good songwriters. You know, maybe I can cozy up to them and if they like whatever I can add to what they're doing, I can get involved in something that has some momentum. You know,
but you've got to offer something a little. I would imagine do you do any writing?
I do, but I'm not, you know, I'm lazy and I'm not prolific. And a part of it, I think, is I've been spoiled by working with people that are so good at it.
Yeah.
That it's sort of intimidating. So I'm like, why am I beating my head against the wall? And, you know, I'll just go play with somebody that's much better at this.
Kathy Richardson, Robbie Foulkes. Yeah, I totally get it.
Yeah, you know, they're very prolific people and they've got constantly, part of it is just having the time to.
Well, you've got to be prolific to be a successful songwriter because it's not like everyone you write, you know, it's like if you do 1 out of 10 that are okay to put on a record, that's probably about the ratio, man, you know?
Yeah, it's like the whole adage, and writers write. You got to, for me, I was like, well, I'm spending so much time just playing and working with other people. I don't really have time to do that. Yeah. And the other thing is I see what these band leaders and songwriters go through trying to get their thing together and rally people like me around their cause. And I didn't want to be that. It's a pain in the ass. And I just don't want to be that.
I totally get it.
Come join me and back me up on my material, you know, because I'm your champion, you know. It's like, I prefer the role of being a sideman, helping someone that I think is much more talented.
Yeah. That's 90% of the guys I interview have the same thing because once you try to get your own thing going, there's a million moving parts that have nothing to do with playing or writing music that you've now got to do. And it's like, shit, man, do I really want this?
Yeah. It's like, you have to be driven.
Getting people to show up. Yeah. Now is your turn. And you don't realize what a headache that is because you're the guy that shows up on time, but maybe not everybody's the same way.
Oh, you know? you're herding cats. You're trying to convince musicians to do things. And part of it too is, you know, in the end, especially as you get older, you just have to have the money to pay these people.
Right. Totally.
You know, and be willing to lay that out and be driven and take the risk on trying to get something up on its feet, you know? So yeah, I found it, you know, much less stressful to let someone else deal with that.
Totally get it, man.
Be the team guy that's brought in to take care of this area, you know, like, okay, this guy's going to be my soloist and, you know, cover all this guitar stuff. So,
but compositionally, you must have a very strong insight because that's, you wouldn't be on all these records. They'd have session guys, you know, like Nashville session, you know, just guys that just do that. You wouldn't be on all these records. So you've got to be able to, you are obviously bringing something to the table that's, you know, a bonus in a sense.
Yeah, I think, and I've certainly worked with acts that I am copying some Nashville players' part, but a lot of it comes down to whether the guy you're working for, or the producer you're working for, is like, I want what Grant is doing.
Or whatever.
Like, I know what he does, so that would sound really cool on this. So we're like having whatever it is, an individual voice or being able to cop a certain thing will get you that session.
Yeah, well, that's good. I'm obviously doing it great. Also, you work with Steve Albini. Is that how you pronounce his name? Albini? Or is that
Steve Albini, yeah. He's a Chicago producer that, you know, did, you know, Nirvana.
Right, I thought so.
And a lot of, he's a punk musician.
The guy with the glasses.
Yeah, he's sort of like that nerd punk look and very edgy. He was in a band called Big Black, I believe is what it was called. And it was a real an edgy punk band. But he has a studio in Chicago and he's done a lot of big records. And Robbie, we worked in there on some of Robbie's records, a variety of different records in there. And we still go in there from time to time.
That's cool.
He's one of those, you know, he's a purist. He only uses tape. Right. He does. There is a Pro Tool room in his studio, but he still uses tape.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So you're still working with Robbie?
Every now and then I do. He live these days. I think he's sort of burnt out on drums and higher volume stuff. He has some hearing loss and some ear damage. So he's playing bluegrass primarily now, or he'll go out with just he and Red Volkert.
I interviewed Red. That guy's a monster.
Red, yeah.
Oh, so my God.
We did stuff together, and I played quite a bit with Red during the time I worked with Robbie, and Robbie just recently played with Red. But so he's not doing the higher volume stuff, so most of the time when I'm working with Robbie, he'll be like, I got a tune, you know, can you come in next Tuesday, and we'll record.
That's but cool.
Not live. Yeah.
Man, I got to go text Red, because this is the second time in 2 days his name's come up in interviews. That's funny.
Yeah, Red's.
He's an incredible player, man.
He is amazing, and he's really hilarious. Even his
funny as hell
playing is hilarious. Yeah, you know,
he
likes to crack you up when he's playing.
Someone was telling me they saw him at the Continental Club, and he had a shirt on. I'm having a brain fart. What is that? It's not a funny thing, but when people don't eat, typically with women.
You mean you like won't eat?
Eat food because they have an issue with their body image. What is that called? What's that called? When people aren't eating? You know what I'm talking about?
Like bulimia?
Yeah. Yeah, something like that. But he had a shirt that said something like,
eating disorder kind of thing.
Yeah, right. He had a t-shirt on that said something like, I beat bulimia. Now, well, for... or something. It wasn't that caustic. because he's a big chubby guy. Yeah, yeah.
He looks like a tugboat captain.
He totally does, yeah. Man. And he's such a it wasn't that it wasn't something that was politically like, oh my god. It was something in that spirit. Like, you know, I found a way to whatever. But it was just really funny. He's a great guy and good player.
He's a great guy. He's got so many funny stories. It's oh my god. He is just. I remember one of the first times I met him, I think it was in Texas, but I can't remember. And we were going to sit in during a show or set. And he's like, here, you take my guitar, you know, and he handed it to me. And it was this big, it wasn't his typical Telly. It was a big Gretsch that had just, you know, telephone cable strings. He goes, they'll go bending. There'll be no bending. And I'm like, no shit.
Oh my god. That's great. Yeah. He's a character, man. Good guy. And then you play with the band Van Ghost. What is that?
Van Ghost was a weird super group. It was a concert promoter who was a songwriter in Chicago. And he started this band because he knew these two girls that tour with Trey Anastasio from Phish,
yeah.
Jennifer Hartswick and Natalie Cressman. And they have a really cool thing going. Natalie is a trombone player and Jennifer is a trumpet player and they both sing. So they're like this roving background singer, horn section thing. So they work with Natalie's father is in Santana's band, and they're just like this jam band, you know, royalty.
That sounds like something I could see Government Mule having on stage.
Well, they all know Jennifer. Yeah. Jennifer's known. So they can just go to a festival and we're like, you need background singers horn section? And of course every band's like, hell yeah. So yeah. They'll just sit there, listen to the songs, come up with a horn section part, sing backgrounds, look great, boom, boom, boom. You know, so they're like artists at large playing with almost every band at every festival when they're not on the road with Trey. So there was those two guys, some of a rhythm section.
Holy crap, you hear that?
Is that lightning?
Yeah, it was thunder and lightning. Holy smokes.
There's supposed to be a storm coming into the Gulf. We may have to fly out of here earlier this week.
Really? It's like that heavy?
There's a tropical depression coming down that they think is going to gain strength in the Gulf.
Oh, man, I hate hearing that stuff.
But anyway, so we recorded and we had the bass player from the North Mississippi All-Stars, Big Chew.
It's a good band.
Yeah, and so we had like an investor and we made a record with Justin Niebank in Nashville and toured around. We opened up for Bruce Hornsby.
Oh, cool.
Big Head Todd, that band Big Head Todd.
Yeah, they're a great band.
Oh, yeah. So, and we also were around playing with the Revivalists, who are very popular right now.
Yes.
From New Orleans. They opened for the Stones recently, I think, down in Florida. But that was a short-lived thing because it was really dependent on people's availability and everybody had to go off and do their other gigs. So sure. That was a short-lived thing. Yeah. I mean, it's odd. It's like between Dick Holliday and like Robbie Foulkes, that was the longest run I really had. And I got to play and record and meet so many people through that run, like legendary, like Red.
Yeah.
And all these were legendary pedal steel players. And like, that was a thing. Like Lloyd Green and John Huey, who are legendary. Lloyd was on Johnny Paycheck Records. And,
oh, wow.
Pride and you know, steel Hall of Fame kind of dudes.
Did you ever
Grand Ole Opry 80th anniversary with Robbie and meeting those guys and recording with them? And that was part of the whole growth thing for me musically, is because I joined Robbie. I hadn't really played straight country like that, and there was pedal steel all over his records, and he couldn't afford to bring a steel player out, so I had to cop.
You had to cop. Those are not easy at all, man.
Right. So that became a big part of a next level of my own style of playing using a Stratocaster, and the vibrato bar and copying this pedal steel slidey kind of stuff.
And that I had a few pedal steel guys on the show. Bruce Boughton, do you know him?
I've heard of him, yeah. I don't know him personally.
Nashville cat. And then I'm having a drawing a blank. But that community is really interesting because if I have a steel player on the show, all of a sudden there's these there's tons of like forums and groups that's exclusive, and man, that show, whatever show I have, it's really blows up, and it's all because I see where traffic comes from, and it's all from these little
pedal steel forums.
That's
a tight knit community.
Very.
I think they really want to learn from each other. It's such a complicated instrument, you know, and they're sort of like, your trick, how are you doing this? It's got a different thing than guitar as far as that. There's a little more idiosyncratic things to glean from each other. And so they kind of stick together.
And it's becoming popular because I've talked to a couple of guys who play pedal steel that live in Brooklyn. There's a big alt country scene in Brooklyn, believe it or not. Yeah.
Oh, definitely. I played in New York quite a bit with Robbie, and there were New York alt country artists.
Totally. Yeah. Rich Hinman, who's now in LA, I think, and then Johnny Lamb, who's really odd because he's an Asian dude playing pedal steel in the first place. You know, that's not common, you know. He's a really good player. But there's a lot of this alt country scene all over. I think it's making a bit of a resurgence amongst the younger kind of folks too.
Yeah, I think some people are maybe a little turned off or burnt by that sort of cookie cutter stuff coming out of Nashville.
Yeah, I think no doubt.
Like a weird hip hop hybrid pop with it might have a pedal steel or a fiddle on it, but it's
disco country, man.
It's
is what
got
it
the
is.
Snap beat, like it's like the hip hop snap beat with sort of white guy rappy.
Yeah, you know, totally. Weird. Yeah.
And then I think some people are like, well, why don't we just listen to some real country?
Yeah. I think the younger people that haven't been exposed to country that like pop music, or that's who it appeals to. I had a guy that was, we went to, my wife and I, we were, you know, I interviewed a player and he was in town and we went to see him play. And it was really funny because, I mean, not that we're young, but we were like granddad and grandma. There was all these young kids, you know, it was like what you said, like disco country kind of, you know?
Yeah. That well, I love is Steve Earle's comment on that. I don't know if you've heard.
No, what did he say?
That new Nashville or bro country or whatever you want
bro
to call
country,
it.
Yes.
It's hip hop for white people that are hip hop for people that are scared of black people.
It is, man. It is. That's a great
definition. I don't know if that's the exact
man.
Wording, but that's
the context. Yeah, that's
hip hop for people that are afraid of black people.
That's what it is, man. Touche.
Yeah, Steve's got some good ones. Yeah.
And you're currently back with Jay O'Rourke.
Yep, man, with Jay O'Rourke. It's right now. It's sort of. I'm playing with Jay O'Rourke. I'm playing quite a bit with Michael McDermott, who is another. Folk rock songwriter who he's always had traction and has been in and out of record deals. He's a really prolific writer.
Great.
And he has a lot of traction in Europe right now.
So you're going over to Europe with him?
I'm hoping that this next spring that I might sort of set up a little residence in Italy or something like that. Dude.
Things could be worse than that.
Yeah, that wouldn't suck. And then sort of hop on with him as he goes around. He's Italy, England, Germany, Netherlands. He's got in France.
Dude, that's awesome. Is that something like your wife can come with you or something like that?
That's what we're hoping.
Oh, that would be cool, man.
You know, my daughter and my wife would go. We would set up a little camp, base camp.
Yeah. That's awesome, man. I hope that works out for you. That'd be really cool.
Me too.
And now you're also with a band called The Social Act, which is – this is where I connected with Grant. I saw this video of a band called The Social Act, which I'd never really heard of, to be honest with you. And this guy was just tearing it up in a solo. And I'm like, holy shit, this dude is awesome. And then I just reached out and then we connected. Talk about The Social Act, and they have an interesting story as well.
The Social Act, they were a band that was – once again, it's these bands that were – and I think – not that any it was exclusive to Chicago, but in the 80s and 90s there was a lot of bands in Chicago and record companies would come in, and sometimes they'd pick one up, you know, Smashing Pumpkins or whatever. Some bands had to leave Chicago to get record deals, but this band was flirting with record deals and had some stuff going on, and then sort of imploded on itself, and now they've resurrected. And actually, the drummer and bass player that I play with Michael McDermott, Steve Gillis is the drummer. He was in Filter.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Wait a minute. Filter, that was Ken Andrews was in that band, I think, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
okay.
So the drummer was, you know, he was in that band for a while. And so we're sort of a rhythm section together in certain bands. And he is a producer and started working on material with Social Act in his studio. And they wanted to start playing live. So he goes, well, I got a rhythm section for you. You know, it's Grant and Steve and Matt Thompson. So let's get this thing going live again. And I'm just going to plug in this rhythm section. So that was our first gig that you saw in Chicago at this place called Martyrs. And we were really just still starting to get to know each other as far as the other folks in that band. And yeah, it's fun stuff to play. Cause it is like that tune in particular, you can kind of get into the sort of a Pink Floyd, it's like psychedelic rock.
Which I love that. That's like kind of,
I love that thing, stuff. Yeah. I love David Gilmour. I love Hendrix.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool, man. And so are they going to be touring at any point, or what's
I think so. I mean, there was talk of some shows in the fall in the Midwest and then also in France, I think maybe Paris. They're talking about that. But
dude, if you get all these things lined up, you're going to have a great like year end.
If we can combine all of that, that would be really good. But I'm somewhat in the dark about what actually is going on with that band. It's kind of like I get an email or a call. Like, can you show up at the studio, or are you available for this date? And that's really it.
Well, I would encourage everybody listening to check out the Social Act and look for the I think it's said in there, Grant Ty with the Social Act. Oh, your name was in there. That's how I knew who you were. Yeah. So it's a killer solo. You got turned on to guitar. No, let me ask you this, because you've done so much. Is it possible to answer top three experiences musically?
Top three experiences musically. A lot of those, it's tough, you know, when you're older like us, because you forget. You're like, oh, yeah, wait a minute. What about that one?
Yeah.
Because a lot of times some of those could be unassuming, like, wow, what a night that was, some sort of magical night on stage. But I met and played with a lot of people through Robbie Foulkes. One was playing with Otis Clay, who was a deep from the south side of Chicago. It's like magic, the guy. It's like you're playing with Al Green or something, you know. And I played some shows with him. And it was Robbie's band backing him up.
Oh, wow.
The Old Town School of Folk Music in Chicago. And he stopped us in the middle of the set and said, Robbie, I think I'm going to have to steal your band.
Really? That's kind of cool, man.
Pretty good. You know,
that's really cool.
Yeah. I mean, you know, he supplemented, he had Robbie's rhythm section. And then he had also his guitar player that he works with for years. His name is Hollywood. And
of course,
he had a horn section.
Oh, so this is a major to do up there.
Oh, yeah.
That's
so
cool.
That
man.
Was definitely a top experience. And then I played with Mavis Staples through Robbie. We were on the road coming back into Chicago, and it was the opening of Millennium Park, which is the huge Frank Gehry stage right on the lake there. And Mavis was scheduled to play. We were scheduled to play opening for her. And she called Robbie while we were rolling into, we were out in the middle of Illinois somewhere. And she said, Robbie, I only have my guitar player. Would you guys think about backing me up after your set? And, you know, you play with me. And we said, sure, Mavis, no problem. And we stopped at a strip mall and got her new record.
That's cool.
and listen to it on the way so that we could sort of chart out the songs and know what we were getting ready to play with her.
Was Rick Holmstrom her guitar player then?
At that time, it was not. It was someone else, and I can't remember his name. And Rick, you know, when she started playing more, and Rick became her guy.
He's been with her for a while.
Yeah, yeah. But so we ended up jumping on stage with her and playing, and then we played a little bit, did some other shows with her too, and she actually did a side record with Robbie that was all Johnny Paycheck cover. Where he had a bunch of different people doing Johnny Paycheck covers. And let's see. Another one definitely was opening for Merle Haggard in Milwaukee with Robbie at the Pabst Theater.
That's nice.
The crowd was super old school Merle Haggard fans. And at first they weren't sure what to think of us, but we won them over big time. And got a standing ovation from that crowd. That meant a lot. And getting a stamp of approval from Merle sort of because of that and talking to him later.
Now, that was Red played with him for a while, but that was probably after.
That was after. Yeah. Red wasn't with him at that time.
Yeah. It's funny. Do you know Dave Spector?
I do.
Dave had a pick. What's that?
I played a show after Otis Clay died, and we recorded one of Otis's tunes that he was famous for doing, and then we did a tribute to Otis. David worked with Otis. Yeah.
He had a picture today of him and Otis Clay on Facebook, and he was, you know, like, I miss Otis. It was an anniversary of his death or something like that, a couple of years, two, three, 4 years or something. And just today, again, this weird always happens here, man. Like, you know, you mentioned Otis Clay. I saw his photo this morning. It's just very strange. Those are some great experiences, man. Really cool.
Definitely. You know, and you know, I did the Grand Ole Opry. It's easy to sort of like, well, what is it, a cool experience to someone else or is it to me? You know,
no, it's just to you. I'm only interested in
playing on Conan O'Brien. It's cool. It's not as cool as you think it might be. It's cool to be on national TV.
Yeah.
You know, don't get me wrong. But some of these other experiences were a lot more gratifying.
Yeah, I totally get that. Because it's another gig when it comes down to it with Conan. There's nothing,
The prevailing memory for me playing with Robbie on Conan O'Brien is that we show up and we did the sound check. We did the song probably four times prior to the show. Everything was fine. And then, of course, when it's live taping, we do the show, my monitor dies. And I'm singing, you know, a high harmony part on the choruses.
Oh, my God.
And I'm like, holy shit, this monitor is dead, you know. And I, after it was done, it worked out. But after it was done, you know, and the tech guys knew it. And they were like, oh, you know, we're sorry, you know. And I said, that's just like every shitty club we play. He didn't like hearing that, you know.
Yeah.
No, but like, I'm used to it. I play honky tonk, so half the time the damn gear doesn't work. So, thanks a lot.
did you see that thing? It was making its way around social media recently. It said, like, as a guitar player, likelihood of making a mistake when you're practicing in your room alone, it was like zero. Somebody walks in, it goes up a little bit. On stage, it's like way over the top. You know, like
of course,
like total 100% probability
going wrong.
Yeah.
Whether it's your own brain and your hands or it's your gear, it's definitely not going to happen in soundcheck. It's going to happen.
Funny how that works. Any low points or dark periods you've had to deal with through life, and how'd you get through them?
I think one was, it was during that time I joined Sonia Dada and that whole, the anxious thing with the,
being
whether you have the gig or you don't have the gig. And prior to that, I had been sort of in a rut playing kind of shitty clubs around Chicago. And, all of a sudden I'm on this bus and I'm playing sold out theaters and, you know, it's pretty cool. And then that rug got yanked out from under me. And there I was back home trying to, make a living. And that was I was kind of went into depression for a while there. My first marriage was falling apart because I'd been on the road too much. So that was a rough time. And that totally was just before. And then I got the gig with Robbie and kind of pulled me out of a rut.
I don't think people realize, thank you for sharing that, by the way. I don't think people realize the average person that listens to music. I always, now that I've sort of like had the opportunity to peek behind the scenes for a while, I don't think the average person realizes how difficult it is to be a working musician, a sideman especially, you know, because you are a business owner, you're an entrepreneur, right? The thing is, though, you're, unlike a lot of businesses, you're really not in control of a business the way you are. Like when you're selling widgets, okay, I got to run some ads and get some leads or knock on some doors. It's really different. And I really, having run my own business for 21 years, I've had good times and bad times. So I really know exactly how emotionally devastating it is sometimes when it's like, holy shit, you're in free fall. What the hell do I do now? And that's a scary position to be in, man.
It is. It's, you know, it's not for the faint of heart, you know. No. You're freelance. So yeah. It can be terrifying, and you got to be prepared to have lean times or figure out a way to get around that or whatever. I mean, more recently, my current wife, who I said was a television producer, she got me into doing audio for television, field audio for network television.
That's great.
So I'm able to do that freelance every now. So if like, you know, it's dry, my calendar's a little lean, I can call these cameramen or I can call NBC or something.
Oh, that's great.
Go do a Dateline television show or...
What does that involve, doing audio for field audio? What does that mean?
You know, it's like you have the mixer recorder. It's a harness that has that and wireless mics on a harness that you wear, and you're
like the sound guy for people out in the field. Oh, wow.
Exactly. So I'm running sound for live TV or television shows, recording the sound, sending it to the cameras.
That's cool, man. That's like kind of probably fun for you, no? Because it's like...
It is fun. Yeah. Well, I did the whole, you know, the Obama presidency. I was in the White House press pool.
Oh, wow.
And do like meet the press and things like that. So you meet a lot of interesting people. I've done some Nova.
Science. That's great.
Yeah, science. I've been like the Fermi lab, you know, all these like super brainy physicists that are studying black holes. And I've done interviews with big sports stars and musicians too.
So tell me a weird or funny experience. You don't have to name names unless you want to or it doesn't hurt you. But what was a weird or funny story, like somebody was really freaky or like nutty or, you know, that was like unexpected or disappointing? You know, they say careful. You don't want to meet your heroes sometimes. Any stories like that where people were just like totally off the wall?
Well, I did do meet the press with Trump when he was running. And seeing the terror in his
people, I literally just spit coffee all over the window of my you said I did Trump. I was like, I just wasn't expecting that. Oh my god!
Oh yeah. So seeing the terror in his employees' eyes when they realized that supposedly the shot we set up was not his good side.
Oh, because they were all, so he's got a good side and a bad side, and everybody has to know that
we're all getting fired. That's just, you know,
I only got a bad side. He's lucky. Oh my god, I was not expecting that. That's the first time I've ever done that. I literally spit up coffee all over the place. Holy shit.
Another funny thing about that particular shoot was it was before a rally in Iowa, in Ottumwa, Iowa, I believe. And in typical Trump fashion, the press passes that were printed and everybody had in this whole big auditorium and everything for Trump, they misspelled the name of the town.
Oh my god. Oh.
So anyway.
Wow. That's pretty funny, man. That's a good gig. That's a really good gig.
It is a good gig in that it I can book it whenever I want. It's high pay. So I can, you know, one or two shoots, I can, you know, make a good chunk of dough and take care of, you know, take care of life.
Well, you don't have to have the downtime. That's what the saving grace is there. Because exactly. When you have that down, because when you have financial stress, man, it puts stress on loads of other shit. Like Ed mentioned, you had your relationship was falling. And that doesn't help, man.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I rode that roller coaster for, you know, decades. And then so it's now we have a child and a mortgage. And so it's much better to have something that I can throw in to supplement instead of having such deep dip to have to worry about.
All right, let's talk about gear for a few minutes.
Sure.
What's your go-to guitar right now? What other two guitars would round out your top three? And has that changed over the years?
I have I'm a little bit of an odd player in that I bought this guitar, this Stratocaster, when I was a teenager.
Oh,
wow. Like junior high school. I saved up money. I wanted a Stratocaster. There was a classified ad in the paper, $325.
That's a lot of money back then.
Yeah, for a teenager.
Yeah.
And my mother drove me out into the sticks, dirt roads. We found this house. It was a black gospel family band. And they had a matching. This is in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Okay.
Actually. And they had a black Stratocaster with a maple neck and a matching black precision bass under the bed. It looked brand new. It was like early 70s or whatever.
Wait, it's a Gilmore Strat.
Exactly. It looks like the Gilmore Strat.
Wow.
And so I bought that from them, and I've been sort of umbilically whatever attached to that guitar my whole life.
That's wonderful, man.
It's pretty much, I have other guitars. For a long time, I couldn't get another guitar to behave like this one, in that the tremolo stays in tune.
Yeah.
Like, it's like a miracle. So that I became so comfortable with that guitar, it's sort of my signature. So I have other instruments that I use for sessions, or if I'm doing shows where you need multiple tunings or different things, like, or a different sound or something. But that is the guitar that is my voice.
That's great, man.
Yeah, you know. So I've been using that one for years and tweaking it. You know,
the original pickups.
For a long time, it did have the original pickups, and then I ended up, because I got so sick of noise from the single coils, I put EMGs in it, and it's not as twangy as a normal Strat, but it's got a little more output, but it solves a lot of problems, and I can do a lot with it. I can make it sound like a lot of other guitars because of the extra output.
Okay. So let me ask you a few questions. Did you buy the EMG that comes with the pick guard already?
It was just a set. No, there was the original pick guard on the guitar. At that point, I just bought a set that has the harness and wiring, but it wasn't in a pick guard.
Because they were an advertiser, and so I put – they have these basically – they call them so I think it's a Fat 55. They're basically PAS in my Les Paul, and they are, mm-hmm. I mean, beyond amazing. I mean, it sounds like I never played this guitar because it feels good, but I had these high-output pickups, and they suck.
It was too much. Yeah.
I'm a blues guy. And they had these super high output pickups, and they awful. Now it sounds like like the British Brown sound, sort of, which is what I
right.
really love.
All the difference. It's like you need that less winding and everything. I think you get more high end, and you can let the amp work more because it's not pummeling it in a weird. I think there's sort of a weird mid range bluntness once you overwind the pickups too much that. To me, is unpleasant. I think it just depends on what you're trying to do. If you're shredding, or there's a ton of gain, maybe it works better for that. But not like you're saying, like a blues thing. It takes away the character of the instrument.
So. That's what I found. But what I was curious at, so now EMG has basically like they have the Gilmore pickups because he's been using. Yeah. So I was thinking about getting that for one of my Strats. I'm curious how that sounds.
They're pretty cool. I mean, Strat purists don't like EMGs because they don't have that super high-end sort of sparkle. So you sacrifice that for a lot of the benefits that you get with those pickups, the sort of real smooth response and full rangeness. And
you know. Oh, the range is the biggest thing with that is the tone knob and the volume knob. It's almost like they went to 20. It's so much. I mean, little tiny movements on the tone knob now are dramatic changes, which is like, wow, this is really cool. You know, and I don't
use you get all these new options.
Yeah. And I really enjoy that. So I'm thinking maybe the same thing with the Strat. And I'm not a high, you know, I think I have noiseless on one of those. And then I think it's fat 50s they call on the other. So I don't, you know, I was just curious. I thought you might have had that. You know, I want to buy that set. I'd just like to speak with someone to see how they like it.
I think it's worth checking out and you can just see how it feels for you, but because you could always sell it, you know?
Yeah.
But my EMGs are older, I think, before they made the David Gilmour set, although I think it's very similar. It has a lot of some of the same controls. I think they used the set that I have and then they sort of maybe did some tweaks for Gilmour.
Sure. Yeah. Dude, you should be like Fender. If somebody from Fender's listening, man, you ought to be a guy they sponsor because you've had the Strat, what is it, 30 years?
Oh, yeah.
Longer, 40?
Longer than that, actually. Yeah.
That's amazing, man.
I did have a sponsorship years ago when I was with Dick Holliday. We were sponsored by Miller Genuine Draft, and then Fender was part of that. So I got a really nice telly from them during that period and some amps and we got some gear out of that.
That's cool.
But it is a funny story that Black Strat of mine. I can send you, I don't have it here, but I could send you a picture because it's an oddity.
Yeah. I'd love to see that actually. Cause you don't see them with the maple neck with like the Gilmour looking ones very much.
Right. Yeah.
Anybody who influences your playing that people might be surprised to hear?
Well, and it's maybe it would be surprising that some of the influence that I have is not from a guitar player. I, years ago, started with Robbie, like I said, I had to start copying this pedal steel stuff.
Yeah.
And then I got into sacred steel. Are you hip to that?
What is that?
It was steel players in black churches. There's like a whole other scene.
Oh, yeah.
And Derek Trucks.
I was going to say, I've heard Derek talking about them.
So I got exposed to them. I was on the road with Robbie. I think we were in Johnstown, Pennsylvania or something like that. And we did a show. And then I walked over to this other tent. It was the gospel tent. And there was this band called the Campbell Brothers. And it's like a family gospel band, and they use one guitar had a synth on it that he sounded like he was playing a B3, but the focus is pedal steel. And they don't do the same kind of things like you would typically hear a pedal steel doing in country music where it's a lot of chordal harmony movement. It's more like single notes that sound like a human voice.
Like Robert Randolph kind of stuff?
Exactly. Yeah. It's this singing, sometimes they call it singing guitar. You know, there's A.J. Gent and the Campbell Brothers.
Right,
I've heard. And I know Derek Trucks is really influenced by that. You can hear it in his playing, and I've heard him talking about
that.
And I started getting into it, and I really was into trying to incorporate that into what I do, sort of copying what I can. Obviously there's a limitation with doing it on a guitar, but that's another, that creates its own unique thing.
Yeah.
Because your limitations make, you know, your interpretation of it becomes a new thing.
Yeah.
So I try to look to that sometimes when I'm looking to find an approach to soloing or a voice. So it's more like singing like a gospel singer, you know, that type of thing, and incorporating that into sort of a rock or bluesy environment or country or whatever like that. So that's cool. Cool stuff.
Your ability to express yourself on the guitar emotionally is really, really good. I mean, that's what drew me, you know, you were just pouring it out on that one solo I heard even. A lot of guys, a lot of players have often said that, I mean, I read a quote from Gilmore. He was like top 10 things Gilmore said. And he said something like, my wife says, if somebody asked me a question, I should answer with my guitar because I'm not very good communicating it. Where do you stand on that? Are you good communicating with emotionally, or are you, is your guitar?
I would say I might be kind of in his camp with that. I guess I'm somewhat like my father was. It's a little tough to express myself that way. I think that is what drew me to playing, because I find it's helpful as almost a conduit of expressing emotion. And that's what I like in other players. Mm-hmm. Players that influence me have that type of a voice. You know, it's like I totally appreciate people with lots of chops and technical ability, and it blows me away. And then like an hour later, I can't really remember what they were doing. I can remember when somebody makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck and puts a lump in my throat.
Yeah, man. I just got that when you were just saying that. Yeah. I just got that sort of goosebumps.
To me, that is music. And that's what, you know, I find that those moments, I'm always striving to get into that zone when it's not easy, and it can be hard, a little bit difficult to get there, but opening into that zone where it's in sort of this other level where there is an emotional direct conduit coming through that kind of almost doesn't have anything to do with music. It is music, but there's something else going on there. And so I'm always searching for that moment, you know, but all things have to be sort of working together to make that happen.
Yeah. Very cool, man.
But that's the goal for me, you know.
Well, you did it on that solo. I can tell you that much. And I'm sure you've been doing it throughout your whole career. You haven't had this good of a consistency of a career not doing it, especially, like I said, getting in the studio. That is, there's no free lunch on that, man. You know?
No.
Well, I mean, because people will take you on the road because you're a good hang. You know, well, you don't have to be the best guitar player, but they're not taking you in the studio because you're a good hang.
Right. There's that Nashville saying that Sidemen, you know, will say, it's like, well, everybody can play well. It's who do you want to hang out with on the bus?
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know,
totally real.
And that's pretty much consistent with everybody I've interviewed says the same thing. You know, it's we're playing 90 minutes, man. You got 22 and a half hours of that guy or that gal better be nice, because you're going to be miserable if they're not, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Do you remember the first record you ever bought?
I'm trying to think, because I had older brothers and I sort of inherited stuff. So
you're the youngest, what I bought.
You know, like I remember I was the pesty little kid, and my brother was listening to the Hendrix and stuff. And so that was sort of what got me excited about, well, that's guitar. That's so cool. Wow. You know, I was so into that. And that probably led me, I probably bought Are You Experienced was probably the first record that I bought for myself, other than just stealing records from my brothers.
That's cool.
You know, we get like ZZ Top. And then I was thinking about this question, and I was like, I know I probably bought some 45s during, you know, my childhood, but I don't really remember what they were. I do remember Are You Experienced having that record. I think that was probably the first one I bought.
Zeray, give me your top three Desert Island discs, knee-jerk reaction, just for right now, like for this minute, because this could change, you know, anytime.
I know, that's the thing with this question. It's sort of like, you'll think of that, and then you're like, no, it's this, you know, or an hour later after the interview, I'll be like, no, it's this. But I'd say, like, Electric Ladyland.
What a great record, man.
One. And part of it, too, if you think about the desert island thing, it's like, what am I not going to get sick of? Which would probably be almost anything if you only had a
right record. Right.
But definitely Electric Ladyland and like Stevie Wonder, even though it's not a guitar record, really, Inner Vision. Yeah.
That's a real popular answer, that record.
There's something magical about, like we were talking about emotion, there's like this emotional, magical thing with that record. And then it's tougher. I don't know, like some old Howlin' Wolf or something, or maybe some old country, you know, like George Jones or something like that.
Have you ever heard of a guy, we were talking about juke joints earlier. There's a guy, what's his first name? Junior Kimbrough.
Yes.
I think he was a Mississippi guy, if I'm playing in juke joints. Have you ever heard his records? Oh my God, they're awesome.
Yeah.
I love listening to him, man.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the things that I didn't really think about when I moved to Chicago, because I was just like, well, this is an opportunity and I'm going to go do this band. Then because I just didn't know much about Chicago. And I got up there and I was like, this is incredible. You could drive during that time in the '80s, you could drive down in downtown in Chicago and you would see what maybe at that time wasn't a bar anymore, but the side of the wall would have the lineup of who was going to be playing there every week. Like, you know, Thursday nights, Howlin' Wolf, Howlin' Wolf is there every Thursday night in this shitty little storefront bar. You know, or you know, John Lee Hooker,
Mike
know?
Bloomfield.
Yeah, everybody, all that, just that whole migration thing, and then being living in that town. You know, I played with Buddy Guy. I've played with Jimmy Johnson.
Like playing with Buddy? Which Buddy showed up that night, man? Because he's got a bunch of different personalities, man. I've seen him in concert.
Very friendly. I think I was actually I don't know if I was playing with Dave Spector. I was sitting in with somebody. It might have been Dave Spector. There's been a couple of times I've been there anyway, but I was playing with Jimmy Johnson, who was another old guard blues guy, because they're really not there.
Oh, yeah.
They're dying. There's not many guys still alive. Like Lonnie Brooks passed away, you know, and it's like all those guys. But Buddy was cool. He wasn't, he was hamming it up a little bit. He was very nice. And he's always been very nice to me. And it was just fun. I mean, it's just trading off a little bit with Buddy Guy.
That's cool.
Yeah. Speaking of Goosebumps.
Yeah, right. There's another blues guy in Chicago. You know Guy King?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He's a good guy.
Yeah. Yeah, there's – yeah. It's endless.
Do you have any non-musical superpowers?
I don't know if there's anything super. I'm into scuba diving. And,
oh, that's unusual. That's cool.
And I'm into, you know, obviously I love doing the sound work for television. You know, yeah, I don't know.
Scuba is really cool. I did that for a while. It's almost like you're in a different world.
It is like space travel.
Yeah. I always thought that.
One of the first times I did it years ago, well, actually, wow. The first time I did it was back before I wasn't certified or anything. I was going to Florida State for a while. And around that area, around Tallahassee, there's all these underground aquifers and springs and caves and stuff. And a guy that I knew said, hey, you want to go cave diving? So my roommate and I said, okay. We weren't certified to go scuba diving and much less cave dive.
Yeah, that scares me, to be honest with you.
He got the gear. He was able to get all the gear we needed from the university. And we drove out in the middle of nowhere, and there was this, it looked like a pond, the water is totally clear, but it went down to an opening that went into a cave system. And, you know, of course, I think we probably smoked pot. Stupid.
Oh, my God. That would scare the crap out of me. Yeah. Holy smokes.
We went down there and went diving all through these caves. Really cool. Just speaking of otherworldly. But then us being inexperienced, we kicked up silt. So before long, visibility went to zero.
Oh, my God.
Luckily, this kid that was down there with us grabbed my friend and I and pulled us together. So our masks are right together, because it was just like
yeah. a milkshake.
And he held a rope up to our masks and made us hold it. And then blindly, we pulled ourselves back through the cave system, trying not to panic and knock our heads against the rocks, and pulled ourselves up to the surface.
Yeah, that's scary, man.
So we easily could have been our last day on Earth.
Yeah.
And we got to the surface, and there's these, you know, hillbilly kids sitting along the edge of the water, and they said, you know, somebody died down there last month.
Holy crap.
I'm glad we didn't meet them if they're still down there.
Yeah, man.
But I love it. I mean, since then I've been certified. I've been to dove in Hawaii and Mexico.
It's beautiful there, man.
Yeah.
Really pretty there.
I love it. I want to introduce my daughter to that.
Oh, that's a cool thing to do. Yeah, that's really, you got a few years left, man. Get it in now.
Before she won't do it with me.
Well, she. That's the thing, man. That's the weird thing about it. All of a sudden, it's like you're like annoying to them.
Embarrassing.
Like, how can I be annoying? This doesn't even make sense. Like, just because you are. Okay. It's like you can,
Right now, I'm the coolest guy on Earth.
Absolutely.
That is going to go poof.
Yeah. Hopefully it won't. You know, some people, I have met a lot of people that it doesn't, but it did with me. And it was just like.
Dodged it?
Yeah. Their daughter just, you know, every kid's different, but it was just devastating for me. I had no way to process any of this stuff at all. And I just used to go to my wife, you know, help me. I'm like really upset. I'm hurt. And she's no, this is normal. So, you know, most important thing your dad taught you.
Well, most for me, it's, would have to be sort of to persevere and be reminded that you're lucky. I mean, my father was in the 101st Airborne in World War II.
Wow.
So whenever, you know, so he went through hell, you know, he jumped at D-Day. He was in the Battle of the Bulge and Holland campaign and, you know, barely made it home alive. And holy so it's always a good thing to have in the back of my mind where if I'm bitching or like, oh, this sucks or oh, my life sucks or whatever, I'm like, you know what? My old man survived the Battle of the Bulge. I think I can handle this.
Yeah, man. That's a you know great I mean? Frame of reference.
It really is. It's like, hey, you know, you're lucky. Just suck it up.
There was a meme going on a while back. I'm not on social media much. I know I've mentioned a few things, but I just happened to see these things and they've stuck out. And the meme was like my dad, and it was like a picture of, you know, someone like your dad. He's 21. He's jumping. He's paratrooping into, you know, enemy territory. And then, you know, my son, and it shows a picture of like a kid with mouse ears on Snapchat at the same age. And it was like, oh my God, what, you know, like the world's going to end, man.
Yeah.
You know, like, and you wonder why, you know, kids struggle with having coping skills because what are they doing? You know, and of course you don't want your kid jumping off planes into war.
But there's a perspective about sort of life and entitlement and how lucky you are. Just the whole thing that's, I don't know.
Yeah. It's different. I know. It's weird.
That's definitely something I hold on to from my old man.
That's great, man. Yeah. Anything that you wish you did differently or anything you regret not doing?
I wish that I had, as far as music goes, I wish that I had, you know, taken the time to learn to play piano and get more sight reading chops, which I did at GIT or whatever. But the thing is that I don't, mainly because I can't, it's not an efficient thing for me to use, so I don't use it. But I wish that I had, you know, gotten more piano chops, you know, and spend a little more time on that. And as we were discussing earlier, I wish early on I had gotten myself into a habit and a mode of writing songs to where it would just be something that was in me. I'm like, well, I'm doing this. I'm doing it.
You know? Right. The discipline of it, the act of it.
Yeah. And I think if I had done that early on, I probably may have been able to develop some good habits with that. Maybe have, because in the end, you know, if you're the guy on the copyright of a tune,
the
check.
You get the check. Yeah. Sight reading is one of the number one answers to that question.
Yeah. I mean, guitar players are notoriously unable to do that. Part of it is because the same note can be found on so many different places on the instrument, as opposed to like a piano. So there can be you can be reading and we're like, well, I could play that in this position or this position. And it gets to be a little much. And early on, I found that I was always just going to use my ear, and it became like, well, this is just faster, you know?
Much faster. And if you have a good ear, honestly, that is, unless you are the guy who does sight reading for a living, the ear is going to be the better asset than the sight reading.
Definitely. So for me, it's worked out that I haven't needed it, but I'm jealous of my wife, who's classically trained pianist, who can just like throw something up and go, I have to hear a recording of it before I could even jump in.
I hear you, man.
Which is odd. But if you take that away from her, then she's in a weird place. If she's not reading, I'm trying to work with her.
Because you're just like, play this, and she's like, I need to see it.
Yeah. So interesting. She wants to learn, you know, pop music and stuff, and she does have a good ear, but still, I like, even just chord construction, she's classically trained. So if she sees the stack of notes on the staff, she'll play it, but she doesn't necessarily know that it's a B flat, you know, major 7 add 9. So if I'm right, I can say, yeah, the next change is it's a 1-4-5 or whatever, but that's a minor 7. It's like, well, what are the notes?
Interesting.
Knowing the chord construction and just, so that's the difference, you know?
Yeah. That is interesting.
So it's a trade-off. So I'm trying to get her to learn some like Professor Longhair and stuff like that, because I got some sheet music and I'm like, she said, whoa, this is like, it's complicated like Bach, you know? That's like
good stuff, man.
Yeah, the left hand, it's like crazy. But since she has the reading skill, I'm trying to get her to get into that stuff.
It's cool that you guys have music in common. That's nice. And Grant, last question, and I really appreciate all your time. And biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of that's been intentional, and how much has just been a part of aging?
I would certainly say the birth of my daughter. It's changed my personality. I mean, I was a road dog for decades, and it ruined one marriage. And, it's typical. It's sort of like maybe self-absorbed. Mm. Like it's all about, you know, what's going on in my head and with whatever I'm doing. So it made me have to care about taking care of someone else and thinking about the whole, you know, the future for myself and her and my family and just the state of the world, like trying to, we're older, so I'm not going to be around if she has a long life, I will not be around for a lot of it. So I got to prepare her to survive and take care of herself. She's an only child.
Oh, that's heavy stuff, man.
Show her the planet, you know, like here I'm in Florida. When I moved here with my parents in 79, there was all this wildlife, you know, and it's just not here anymore. So like, I want to show her things that she may not see in 20 years.
Yeah.
Like, check this out, go scuba diving with her, or go to show her wildlife. And
you know, fishing, man. Have you taken her fishing?
I haven't. So
yeah. That's really cool to do. My daughter, she loved that. We did that quite a lot. Yeah.
I want to connect her to the earth, you know, whatever, it's cliche, but they're the ones that are going to have to take care of the mistakes that us old folks and the generations before us have done. So maybe they write the course, and so that it's not too unpleasant when they're our age.
Yeah, hopefully, man. Totally, man. Yeah. Hey, listen, first of all, thank you very much. I really appreciate all your time. You're really generous with it, and I really enjoyed talking with you. Let me tell people where to check you out. It's Grant Tye, T-Y-E. Go to his website, Grant, G-R-A-N-T, Tye.com, T-Y-E. You could also find him on Facebook at Grant Tye. On Facebook, he posts up all his gigs there. The Social Act, check them out. Really cool band. You guys have something going on in Chicago. I think you said maybe in September.
I think it's September, maybe at City Winery or awesome. I'm not sure the venue.
Check out the Social Act. Really cool band. And Grant is a great guitar player, man. He's a very soulful cat, extremely expressive. And I'm like, I think that's such a cool story about your guitar, man. Like, that's literally, you're the first guy in like 550 people that's told me that.
People make fun of me, you know, it's like, if they see a picture, because I used to have long blonde hair, you know, and they're like, oh, but I see that guitar. That same Strat, it's all beat up and the paint's taken off of it and everything. And, you know, and people always come up to me and want to talk to me about it because I have it set up sort of like Jeff Beck, where the bridge is floating and up, so that I figured out a way that I could pull up to chords. So, you know, like the high E goes up a half step, the B goes up a full step, and the G goes up a step and a half. So, you know, I can hold a cowboy D chord down at the bottom of the neck, pull the vibrato bar up, and it turns into a C chord.
That's really cool, man.
That's part of that whole pedal steel thing, so that I found that I could move harmony around with the way I have my bridge set up, which is, it's pretty similar to Jeff Beck's setup, I think, with the bridge.
Dude, you do anything like Jeff Beck, I want to go see you play. Let me tell you.
I wish I could do. I mean, I love trying to rip him off.
It's funny. We talked about expressiveness on the guitar. I had Gilmour's drummer and Pink Floyd's drummer and their bass player on the show. And their bass player has known David for like 25, 30 years. They've been playing together. And I said, now I'm having I can't remember his name. This is really embarrassing. I've had so many people come through in such a short time. That's the problem.
Oh, sure.
Anyway, so I said, is there any chance that David would come on the show? He goes, in short, no. He doesn't do these kind of interviews. And he certainly doesn't need me to sell anything, believe me.
Right.
Which I totally get. But he goes, you might, because he's played with Jeff Beck. He goes, Beck, I could see coming on. So I got my fingers crossed, you know.
Sure hope you get to talk. He's definitely one of my favorites. It's always just like unbelievable what he does.
It's out of this world. It really is. And he's just got such a gift with that with the Strat.
Right. His control over it and his pitch and just, I don't know how he is consistently able to sort of reproduce some of these things without. Yeah.
I interviewed two of his guitar players, Jennifer Batten, who's a great guitarist in her own right, and Carmen Vandenberg, who was on this last tour. And I asked them both, I said, how does Jeff do that? And Jennifer said, Craig, I played with him for 3 years. I studied him every night. I have no idea. I'm not any closer to how he does it today than I was before I started the tour. And she's a really bright, talented musician. So
definitely. She's a monster. And I don't know. It's hard to figure out. It's sort of like you can watch him and you can try. I can cop some of the things that he does, but I'm not sure I'm doing it like he did it. Yeah. I'm just get the sound of it.
Yeah.
But I definitely sort of incorporated sort of the setup that he has and then went my own direction, you know, with how to use it.
Well, man, you're doing something right. So keep it up. Everybody support Grant's music. Check him out and come see him with the Social Act and go to his Facebook page. It's GrantTye.com. Go there as well. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this interview, please share it on your social media channels with your friends. We appreciate your support. Thanks very much to Grant Tye for spending time with us. I really appreciate it, man. I enjoyed talking with you. Make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list. I'm wiping the coffee off the screen. So sign up to get on our get on our newsletter list so you and I can connect. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. Grant, thank you very much.
All right.
We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.